I'm going to give you a rundown of what it is that we're going to be hearing on the prepared portion of the broadcast this evening. We're actually going to begin by listening to the larger part of the prepared portion of last week's program. This is because the subjects that I was discussing last week, namely the intersections between a number of ongoing investigations, such as the Iran-Contra affair, the BCCI, the Inslaw case, the October surprise, these intersections between these various cases, and they are all very heavily intersected, will provide a basis for a very important, though frankly very disturbing development which took place in the news this past week, namely the very suspicious death of a fellow named Joseph Daniel Casolaro. Casolaro was an investigative reporter who was working on some of the intersections between these cases. He turned up an alleged suicide under very strange and disturbing circumstances. Many people, myself included, are extremely skeptical that in fact Casolaro's death was the suicide the authorities are maintaining it was. But we are going to begin, as I said, by looking at the subject of last Sunday's broadcast, namely some of the intersections, between these various cases. And then we will jump to the present. We're going to begin by taking a look at an article from the San Jose Mercury News on this past Wednesday, August 14th. This is a Boston Globe story which talks about the death of Danny Casolaro, as his brother calls him, and talks about the intersections between the various cases that I had been speaking about last week. This is an intersection, a phenomenon that Casolaro himself has termed the octopus. And that is also a metaphor that I myself have used on a number of different occasions. We'll review that in a second. Apparently, Casolaro's death is not the only suspicious death of people involved in investigating some of these intersecting links. It should be noted that the BCCI case, one of the intersecting links or one of the tentacles of what Casolaro refers to as the octopus, the BCCI case has also produced a death or two, and we're going to take a look at a fellow named Yang, who died down in Guatemala, apparently investigating the BCCI. We're also going to take a look at some of the inconsistencies in the official case, namely the fact that Danny Casolaro's notes seem to have disappeared. Also, there was a bottle of wine, half drunk, or half consumed, I should say, and Casolaro had no alcohol in his bloodstream at the time of his death. It should be noted in this context that Casolaro had been embalmed by the authorities in West Virginia illegally, because the authorities there, that is to say his family, had not been notified of his death. That's certainly the premature embalming of Casolaro will certainly make any sort of objective forensic finding in his situation very difficult to achieve. We're then going to take a look at an article from the LA Times of Friday, August 2nd of 1991. We've looked at this before. This concerns Robert Keith Gray and a number of people who have been involved in helping to apparently frustrate the investigation into BCCI. I mentioned Robert Keith Gray, an intimate of Edwin Wilson's, because Robert Keith Gray is another of the individuals whose names has cropped up in connection with October Surprise and obviously also the BCCI. We're next going to review some information from the Village Voice, specifically from Doug Ireland's press clips. And we're going to take a look at some interesting information which maintains that Robert Gray's name was in the Madrid hotel register at about the time that William Casey and others were alleged to have met with the Iranians concerning the October surprise. By the way, the October surprise is the apparent deal cut between the Reagan-Bush campaign and the Khomeini forces in Iran to oblige the withholding of the U.S. hostages taken from the United States embassy there in November of 1979 until after Jimmy Carter's humiliation and consequent election defeat were assured. Robert Keith Gray, as I said, is one of the individuals whose names turned up on the hotel register in Madrid at the time that Casey and others were allegedly having this meeting. We're going to take a look at that from Doug Ireland's press clips. And then we're also going to take a look at a piece of hard information indicating that there definitely was contact between the Reagan-Bush campaign and the Khomeini forces in Iran, namely documents concerning or documents that were given to the Reagan-Bush campaign for Reagan's debates with Jimmy Carter in 1980. These documents were taken from the United States Embassy in Tehran in November of 79. Obviously, their presence in the Reagan campaign hands indicates a contact, hard information of contact of some kind between the Khomeini forces and the Reagan-Bush campaign. One of the hard investigative links in the October surprise concerns the Hashemi brothers, Reza, Cyrus, and Jamshid Hashemi, who were involved in a weapons deal which they maintain was inextricably linked with the October surprise. We've discussed the Hashemis before, and most recently in connection with J. Stanley Pottinger, an individual who was a friend of George Bush's, an individual who, according to Fred Landis and Donald Freed, helped cover up the assassinations of Orlando Letelier and also Martin Luther King, an individual who for 9 years, including the period of time when he was involved allegedly with the Hashemis and perhaps with October Surprise, an individual who also was Gloria Steinem's paramour for many, many years, Steinem herself having a background in the CIA. Then we're going to take a look at a couple of very disturbing aspects concerning the recent assassination of former Iranian Prime Minister Shapour Bakhtiar. Bakhtiar was stabbed to death in Paris. I wonder whether that might have had something to do with October's surprise, whether or not that's the case. It appears that the authorities, on no fewer than two occasions to date, had the killers or alleged killers in hand and yet let them go for whatever reason. Not something we can draw any conclusions about, but something that I find very disturbing. We're then going to take a look at an article from today's San Francisco Sunday Chronicle or Examiner and Chronicle, today being August 18th, for the benefit of people who listen to this program by tape. And we're going to take a look at the report from a House Republican Task Force on Terrorism that George Bush's assessment of terrorism being on the wane is inaccurate. This is a report that I find disturbing because this particular group is one of those nexes, perhaps, that is very much involved with the counterterrorism-terrorism milieu, and those two organizations are inextricably linked. Now, that is to say, not to organizations, but counterterrorism and terrorism are inextricably linked, and we're going to take a look at this report disputing George Bush's assessment of terrorism. What I find ominous about this is that if, in fact, some of these investigations, such as the Iran-Contra, October Surprise, BCCI, etc., if they do indeed go forward as planned, among the scenarios I hold open is the possibility of staging a provocation in order to either cancel the investigations or perhaps to force the implementation of martial law under the Rex 84 Operation Night Train martial law contingency plans that we've looked at before on this program. Then we're going to look at an interesting, one of many interesting connections between elements of the U.S. national security establishment and some of the very terrorists that they are supposed to be working against. We're going to take a look at a fellow named Mazed Rashad Faron, the brother of Gait Faron, one of the principals in the BCCI case, and we're going to take a look at his intersection with the STBOM Arms for Drugs ring that we looked at in Radio Free America number 20 in connection with the shooting of the Pope, and we're going to take a look at an attempt by Mr. Faron and others to secure some atomic bombs for Libya. And this is disturbing, obviously, because we're going to take a look at the participation of elements of U.S. intelligence in this particular operation. That's one of the reasons why I'm worried about a provocation rearing its ugly head if, in fact, some of these investigations proceed as planned. We're going to conclude the prepared portion of tonight's broadcast by taking a look at a very important development which emerged in the news this past week, namely a link between a DEA operative named Perez and the escape from Costa Rica of John Hull, one of the principal defendants in the Christic Institute case, one of the people apparently helping John Hull escape, along with the aforementioned Mr. Perez, a fellow named Dagoberto Moises Nunez, also, like John Hull, one of the defendants in the Christic Institute suit against some of the principal figures in the Iran-Contra scandal. Oh, I should say also that after taking a look at the Casolaro case, one element I forgot, we're going to listen to a very short section of an interview that I did with Daniel Sheehan in November of 1990, in which I also use, as I have many times on the air, the metaphor of an octopus to describe the many significant and ongoing intersections between many of the cases that I've been examining on this program and that others, including the late unfortunate Joseph Daniel Casolaro, have been looking at as well. That's basically what we have on tap for this evening, so fasten your seatbelts, get your tapes ready to roll, because we're going to be proceeding with the prepared portion of tonight's broadcast in just a couple of minutes after a short musical break. Well, good evening. Welcome back once again to the prepared portion of tonight's broadcast. As I indicated a couple of minutes ago, what we're going to be doing this evening, to begin with, is reviewing a large portion of the prepared portion of last week's broadcast, this by way of leading into a very disturbing death, I suspect an assassination, certainly a death, but a very suspicious death, an alleged suicide. And the individual who was the victim in this case, a fellow named Joseph Daniel Casolaro, was investigating some of the very same connecting links between a number of ongoing investigations, which was the subject of last week's prepared portion. For that reason, by way of leading into the current breakings in this particular regard, I'm going to play the vast portion of the prepared portion of last week's broadcast. What you're about to hear for a period of time constitutes the bulk of the prepared portion from last week's One Step Beyond show. Last week, for the benefit of those who hear this on tape, was August 11th of 1991. Here we go, for those of you who are taping. One of the interesting stories that has emerged over the past Well, a lot of interesting stories have emerged over the past several months or so, and actually I shouldn't say they emerged for the first time, but there are a lot of investigations going on. A particularly asinine column by an individual whose work I don't think too much of, a guy named Charles Krauthammer, K-R-A-U-T-H-A-M-M-E-R, appeared in a number of different publications, Los Angeles Times, among others. This particular article was sent to me by someone from who gleaned it from the Albuquerque Journal of July 8, 1991. In fact, this was sent to me by Dave, our Napa Sentinel with a small s, the individual who has been acting as sort of a liaison between yours truly and Harry Martin. This particular story is, well, it's a ridiculous column. It's called Americans Are Looking for Conspiracies, and I'll just give you a brief sample of this ridiculous column. There is no romance in being inadvertently killed by your doctors, and no satisfying sense of justice at discovering death by natural causes. Hence, the eternal quest for the satisfaction that comes from conspiracy uncovered. This particular statement is in allusion to the digging up, the exhumation, and analysis of the remains of former President Zachary Taylor, who some maintained was poisoned. I don't know anything about Zachary Taylor beyond what is public information, whether or not the man was poisoned. That conclusion was ridiculed by the investigation. The point is that Krauthammer here goes on to poo-poo all of the stories that are coming out as being of no substance, and is sort of musing, as have many people, about why are Americans all of a sudden looking for conspiracies under every rock? Well, if Americans are looking for conspiracies, and I for one am not satisfied that they're looking for conspiracies, they certainly don't have too far to look, because conspiracies are exploding all around us in the media. One of the conspiracies which may come to light to a certain extent concerns the October surprise, the apparent deal cut between the Reagan-Bush campaign and the Khomeini forces in Iran, as I said, to withhold the U.S. hostages taken from the embassy, the United States embassy in Tehran, until after Jimmy Carter's humiliation and consequent election defeat were assured. It should be noted that these allegations are going to be investigated by the House Foreign Affairs Committee. The information came out this past week. Specifically, the papers of Tuesday, August 6th, contain information about the opening of this probe. The San Jose Mercury News 48691 contains the following story. It's headlined, Congress Will Probe Hostage Deal. It's by David Hess of the Mercury News. I'm not going to read it. Suffice it to say that the House Foreign Affairs Committee, chaired by Lee Hamilton, is going to be conducting the investigation. That is not the most exciting piece of news for yours truly, because Lee Hamilton conducted a less than vigorous investigation of the Iran-Contra scandal. The Iran-Contra scandal is directly connected to the October surprise. There are indications that the arms transfers from the United States to Iran began as a result of the October surprise, with Israel acting as the middleman or middle party, at least in the beginning. One of the story about the opening of the probe came out on August 6th. August 5th was the actual announcement by the congressional leadership of the opening of the probe. This past week, specifically on Thursday, the former prime minister of Iran, Shapur Bakhtiar, the last prime minister under the Shah of Iran, was stabbed to death in Paris. I'm going to read you a little bit of this particular assassination. This comes from the Los Angeles Times of Friday, August 9th of 1991. This story is datelined Paris and headlined, Prime Minister under Shah is slain in France. The article opens, Shapur Bakhtiar, B-A-K-H-T-I-A-R, the late Shah of Iran's exiled prime minister and an outspoken foe of Tehran's current government, and Bakhtiar's secretary were found stabbed to death Thursday near Paris, despite heavy security, the French Interior Ministry said. Skipping down in the story, former Iranian President Abolhassan Banisadr, who lives in exile near Paris, told French radio he feels under threat. Bakhtiar's murder, quote, was ordered by the mullahs of Iran, Banisadr charged. Quote, again quoting, 3 or 4 days ago, I received a list of oppositionists that the regime had decided to suppress. Among them was Shapur Bakhtiar, he said. Again quoting, I received information saying that this time it was very serious and that the mullahs in power had decided to suppress me as well. There are a number of questions I have about this particular assassination. I wonder if Shapur Bakhtiar might have had information about the October surprise. I also take note of the fact that Abolhassan Banisadr, the former Iranian president, said that it was his information that the same people who eliminated Bakhtiar were going to try and eliminate him as well. One of the things that I note in this context is that Abolhassan Banisadr has definitely come out in support of the October surprise hypothesis. He has come out with a book which he recently toured the United States in promotion of, and he maintains in the book that the October surprise did in fact take place. There are a number of questions I have about the Bakhtiar assassination. As indicated, he was stabbed to death despite the fact that there was very, very heavy security around the building in which he was murdered. And his an associate of his was murdered as well. The conviction here, at least in this article, and the statements that have come to light so far, blame the killing on Iranian militants. That may very well have been the case. I wonder, though, whether the Bakhtiar assassination might have been conducted or carried out in connection with the October surprise. I also wonder if this is perhaps setting the stage for the assassination of Abul Hassan Bani Sadra, one of a number of individuals who could bring information about the October surprise to light. I also note again that Bakhtiar was under very, very heavy security in France, and apparently that served him. It was of no avail. I would also note, too, that there are some seemingly contradictory things going on the world stage at this time. We have Iranian-connected terrorist groups releasing hostages in Lebanon, and at the same time, there are more. A French worker was kidnapped this past week. At the same time, we are seeing a heightening of what we are told is Iranian terrorism abroad. The two would seem to be contradictory. I wonder to what extent, as I said, the assassination of Bakhtiar might have had something to do with October surprise or the opening, the announcement that the House Foreign Affairs Committee will be conducting a formal probe. I also wonder if the same assassins who dispatched Bakhtiar might also get Bani Sadra, as Bani Sadra has indicated he was told they would. Bani Sadra definitely has information about October surprise. And I wonder if the killers were really Iranian militants or whether they might have been working on behalf of some element of the U.S. intelligence establishment, the George Bush faction in particular. I also wonder whether perhaps if in fact these were Iranian militants who carried out the killing, whether perhaps they are being actively aided by elements of U.S. intelligence. It occurs to me that perhaps the releasing of the hostages might have something to do with October surprise. If George Bush is attempting to discredit the October surprise allegations, getting the U.S. hostages out of Lebanon might be one way of psychologically refuting the October surprise situation. Obviously, the October surprise allegations cannot be directly refuted by anything George Bush could do in Lebanon. But if George Bush can be seen as obtaining the release of hostages from the Middle East, that will psychologically tend to counteract the view in some people's mind that George Bush might have been involved with October surprise, as I and many other people believe he was. That would make George Bush look like, in the public's mind, look like the freer of hostages rather than the keeper of hostages that he apparently was. I also wonder, again, what connection there might be between the releasing of the hostages in Lebanon and the upsurge of apparent Iranian terrorism abroad. The two would appear to be contradictory, and I wonder what relationship, if any, exists between the two. Why we're seeing Iranian-connected militants in Lebanon freeing U.S. hostages while an apparent upswing in Iranian-sponsored terrorism abroad is being conducted. That is not a relationship that I fully understand, but I wonder why we're seeing these two seemingly contradictory things at the same time. I also wonder whether perhaps a deal is being cut behind the scenes again between the Bush forces and people in Iran. I wonder if there's been perhaps, and this is pure rumination, I wonder if perhaps there's been a deal in which the U.S. hostages would be freed and George Bush in turn would turn a blind eye to Iranian assassination, whether it's Shapur Bakhtiar or the Japanese translator for the Satanic Verses by Salman Rushdie. He was stabbed to death in Japan a few weeks ago. I wonder if perhaps the Iranians have decided to do George Bush a favor and help eliminate some of the people who might shed light on the October surprise. As I've indicated, this is pure rumination on my part. There may be nothing whatsoever to it. But I find it interesting that the hostages are being released in Lebanon at the same time as we're seeing an upsurge in apparently Iranian-sponsored terrorism abroad. That they would appear to be contradictory to me, but I wonder what, if anything, is the nature of the relationship between these two events. Among the many conspiracies, quote-unquote, as Charles Krauthammer would have referred to them, among the many conspiracies which are actively under investigation, and as I indicated at the top of the broadcast, many of these conspiracies are connected, Among the many conspiracies currently under investigation, and among the many interlocking conspiracies under investigation, is the Iran-Contra scandal. Obviously, the Iran-Contra scandal does connect up directly with the October surprise. The October surprise appears to have been the opening of the arms transfers, the clandestine arms transfers to Iran. It should be noted that Iran-Contra Special Prosecutor Lawrence Walsh is pursuing the investigation into Iran-Contra with renewed vigor in this past week. The information emerged that the investigation is moving in the direction of a number of former and active CIA officials, Claire George being one of them, Dewey Claridge being another fellow named Gruner, and as indicated a few weeks back, Alan Fiers, the former chief of the CIA Central American Task Force, rolled over, in effect, and implicated some of his superiors in some of the activities involved with Iran-Contra. A story that I touched on in Radio Free America 35, once again entitled The December Surprise, The Politics of Terror and the Exoneration of the Secret Team. One of the major elements in my December Surprise hypothesis was the death of Amiram Nir Nisker in a plane crash in Mexico on December 1st of 1988. Nir was a former Israeli intelligence operative, heavily involved with Ali North and George Bush, among others, in some of the Iran-Contra-related activities. I suspect that his death in that plane crash was not accidental and may have been, and I suspect it was an active part of the cover-up of the Iran-Contra scandal. And I would refer listeners to Radio Free America 35 to go into the December surprise hypothesis. That's a very complex and complicated, very involved working hypothesis that I floated in December of 1988, linking, among other things, the bombing of Pan Am 103 and the death of Amiram Nir Nisker to the cover-up of the Iran-Contra scandal. We will be going back into the bombing of Pan Am 103 and a December surprise update in weeks to come. Now, there was a break-in into the home of the widow of Amiram Nir, and some documents were taken. No valuables were taken, but some documents were taken. I had seen a number of articles about that particular break-in. I did not see, however, the Washington Post account of that particular break-in, and apparently there was a statement made. A statement was in the Washington Post article, and this came from Reuters, that the documents and tapes that were taken related to the Iran-Contra affair. The following article comes from the Village Voice of July 30th of 1991 in Doug Ireland's press clips, Ireland just as in the country Ireland. Doug Ireland's press clips has the following little item. Then there's the burglary of the home of the late Amiram Nir, N-I-R, former advisor on counterterrorism to the Israeli Prime Minister, who was one of the key Israelis at the center of Iran-Contra and who was killed in a mysterious 1988 plane crash in Mexico. Friday's Washington Post ran a Reuters report that, quote, documents and tapes related to the Iran-Contra affair have been stolen from the home, unquote, of Nir's widow. Now, I had seen articles about the burglary and talked about documents having been taken from the home, also emphasized that no valuables were taken from the home, but this is the first account that I have seen that the documents did, in fact, relate to the Iran-Contra affair. And again, I would note that there are a number of investigations currently going on, all of which intersect with one another to a certain extent. One of the major investigations currently going on is the investigation into the collapse of the Bank of Commerce and Credit International, the BCCI, an institution with, as I like to say, more connections than a switchboard. BCCI's connections include terrorists, the CIA, a number of people involved in one aspect or another of the Iran-Contra scandal. And one of the people that I mentioned as being involved with BCCI, and one of the most important connections of BCCI, in my opinion, concerns the use of BCCI by a fellow named Arif Durrani. His last name is D-U-R-R-A-N-I, according to an account in Europeo magazine of August 25th of this of 1990. Arif Durrani was the quality control individual for the Iranian end of the arms transfers conducted under Iran-Contra. According to the information presented there, Arif Durrani was seeing to it that the quality of the weapons being delivered to the Iranians was up to par. In an article that appeared in the New York Times of Saturday, July 13th of this year, this article authored by Jeff Girth, there was a description of an individual who I was quite sure was Arif Durrani. I mentioned that when I read the article some weeks back. And in fact, I think it was July 13th of this year. And it was not June 13th, but it was July 13th of this year. Interestingly enough, the Arif Durrani connection emerged in an article in the business section of the Los Angeles Times this past Friday, August 9th. In fact, that individual named was Arif Durrani, And there's a long article. I'm only going to read a short section of it, and I will be going into this particular article when we go into the Bank of Commerce and Credit International. I will be doing an archive show about that in the not-too-distant future. This, once again, is from the Los Angeles Times on the front page of the business section of Friday, August 9th of 1991. This is an article by Gregory Crouch, C-R-O-U-C-H, of the L.A. Times. It's headlined, BCCI Los Angeles Office Clean, quote-unquote, its ex-manager says. And skipping down into the article, Pakistani weapons dealer Arif Durrani, for instance, had a $2 million line of credit at BCCI Los Angeles and used deposits in his mother's account there to finance an arms smuggling operation to Iran between June and September of 1986, according to bank records obtained by federal prosecutors. So, once again, Arif Durrani, a key player in the Iran-Contra scandal and an individual who figures in the investigation of the Arrow air crash and Gander, Newfoundland itself, almost certainly connected to the Iran-Contra scandal and not the accidental crash we are told it was. Arif Durrani, one of the many people involved with Iran-Contra, who was also involved with BCCI. And as I've indicated, there are so many investigations going on now that connect up with one another. It's really a very exciting time for someone involved in this type of research. Among the people involved with both BCCI and the Iran-Contra scandal are former Panamanian strongman Manuel Noriega. Noriega was a key individual involved with some of the Contra-related drug trafficking and an individual heavily involved with Operation Black Eagle that we went into. This concerned Adler Barry Seal and some of the cocaine trafficking, which was used to finance some of the Contra arms purchases in the Iran-Contra scandal. The drug trafficking angle of the Iran-Contra scandal was one of the many areas that Lee Hamilton, the aforementioned Lee Hamilton of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, declined to go into. Among the investigations currently proceeding, and among the interlocking investigations currently proceeding, is the investigation into the situation of Manuel Noriega. He is going to be standing trial, and this past week, specifically in the papers of Thursday, August 8th of 1991, there was a very, very important and interesting story about the judge calling for documents requested by Manuel Noriega's defense. These documents would link the Noriega drug traffic up with the U.S. intelligence community. Reading from the San Francisco Examiner of Thursday, August 8th of 1991, we find the following story. It's an AP story, Dateline Miami, headlined, Judge Calls for Noriega Documents, subheaded, Data May Show Work for U.S. And again, this is Dateline Miami. It reads in part as follows. A federal judge ordered the government Wednesday to turn over classified documents at the heart of Manuel Noriega's efforts to show he worked with U.S. intelligence agencies in Central American drug deals, a source said. The Seal ruling followed a week of closed hearings last month attended by prosecutors, defense lawyers, and attorneys for the CIA and State Department. Quote, it is now not going to be what the government wanted it to be, a garden variety, run-of-the-mill drug case, defense attorney Frank Rubino said after reading U.S. District Judge William Hovner's 41-page opinion. Quote, it's going to be in the context of what was really happening in Central and South America involving the intelligence communities, he said. Well, Rubino was an individual who was savagely attacked. When he began taking on the Noriega defense, he was beaten over the head, supposedly there was no connection with this, as he was attempting to get the government to release secret documents. I would also note that the key witness in the prosecution of a Noriega co-defendant died in a mysterious automobile accident just hours before he was to give testimony. It'll be interesting to see what comes of this order by the judge for the government to release these documents. This could prove very, very explosive if it could be proved in court that the U.S. government and the intelligence services were actively collaborating with Noriega in the drug traffic. Well, again, the implications could scarcely be exaggerated. They are the implications are enormous. And once again, we have a correlated case currently under investigation. The Noriega situation hooks up with the Iran-Contra scandal. It also hooks up with BCCI. Noriega is one of the many people with connections to BCCI who also is involved with the Iran-Contra scandal. And in particular, as I said, the Contra-related drug traffic. One of the better articles about the BCCI scandal emerged in Time magazine of July 29th of 1991. It's the cover story for that particular issue of Time. The story is called The Dirtiest Bank of All, subheaded How BCCI and its Black Network Became a Financial Supermarket for Crooks and Spies, and How the U.S. is Trying to Cover Up its Role. It's by Jonathan Beatty, B-E-A-T-Y, and S.C. Gwynn, G-W-Y-N-N-E. We will be going into this story at greater length in weeks to come. We've covered part of it last week. I'm just going to read you a very short section about some of the mysterious aspects of BCCI. Skipping down in the story, in one of the most mysterious events in the case, BCCI bank records from Panama City relating to Noriega disappeared, quote-unquote, in transit to Washington while under guard by the Drug Enforcement Administration. After an internal investigation, the DEA said it had no idea what had happened to the documents. It'll be interesting to see what if those documents ever turn up. It'll also be interesting to see if the Noriega defense can get a hold of the articles, the documents that they are seeking in relation to Manuel Noriega's defense. Another of the interlocking cases, which is currently coming to light, concerns the Inslaw case. That's spelled I-N-S-L-A-W. There is a miscellaneous archive show called We Have Ways of Making You Sell about the Inslaw case. It should be noted that Inslaw, although it has not received nearly as much notice as some of the other cases, is currently under investigation. It might not appear to the average observer to be quite as sexy, quote-unquote, as some of these other investigations, but Inslaw is very, very important. To make a very long story very short, and it's a very complicated case, Inslaw was a computer software company that had developed the Promise, spelled P-R-O-M-I-S, software. This was a case tracking, a case management software program, which had been sold to the Justice Department, or the Justice Department had received, had contracted with Inslaw to use the Promise software. The Justice Department then did not pay Inslaw and attempted to drive it into bankruptcy and in order to obtain the Promise software for itself. There are indications that the Hadron Company, H-A-D-R-O-N, the main figure there being a fellow named Earl Bryan, a former Reagan aide, and also a person allegedly involved in the October surprise. Earl Bryan was the main figure involved with Hadron and was attempting to pirate the Promise software from Inslaw. The Promise software, I should say, was distributed illegally to other federal agencies and is in use by them. It also was illegally distributed by the Justice Department to foreign intelligence agencies, and at least in some cases it appears that an override password was put into the Promise software, which would permit the CIA or the US, other U.S. intelligence agencies to access the computer banks of foreign intelligence services. There are also indications that, in fact, the Promise software and the pirating of it was part of an operation connected to Iran-Contra. There are allegations by a fellow named Michael Reconosciuto, quite detailed allegations, also by Ari Ben-Menashe, a former Israeli intelligence agent, that there was a joint venture between the Wackenhut Corporation and the Cabazon Indians, spelled C-A-B-E-Z-O-N, Indians of Indio, California, a separate nation legally and consequently not subject to U.S. customs regulations. There is substantive evidence, and again I went into this in the Inslaw Miscellaneous Archive show, that this joint Wackenhut Corporation, Wackenhut is a private security outfit with strong links to the national security establishment. There was a joint Wackenhut Indio or Cabazon Indian venture to not only traffic weapons and various munitions abroad, but also, among other things, apparently to traffic the Promise software abroad as well. And much of the proceeds from this Wackenhut Cabazon Indian venture went apparently to the Contra support effort, and there are indications that perhaps the sale of the Promise software may very well have been used in part to finance the Contras. It should also be noted that Michael Reconosciuto, one of the principal players in this Wackenhut Cabazon Indian venture, Michael Reconosciuto stated in an article that appeared in the Washington Post this past spring that the pirating of the Promise software was done in part to reward Earl Bryan, a former Reagan aide, for his alleged role in the October surprise. So we have connecting links or allegations of connections between Inslaw and the Iran-Contra scandal, and also between the connecting October surprise. It should be noted, too, that we do not want to lose sight of the Inslaw case while all of these other cases are coming to light. Reading now from the New York Times of July 30th of 1991, by the way, research credit on this goes to a listener. This particular article by David Johnston is headline or Dateline Washington, and it's headline, Administration to Fight House Panels Subpoena. Skipping down in the story, one subpoena issued by the subcommittee, this is the House Judiciary Subcommittee, or rather it's the particular is the Judiciary Committee and its Subcommittee on Economic and Commercial Law. That's the subcommittee of the House Judiciary Committee. Skipping down in the story, one subpoena issued by the subcommittee seeks hundreds of documents from the Justice Department relating to its activities regarding Inslaw Incorporated, a computer software company that has accused the department of stealing One subpoena issued by the subcommittee seeks hundreds of documents from the Justice Department relating to its activities regarding Inslaw Incorporated, a computer software company that has accused the department of stealing the company's computer programs that are used to keep track of civil and criminal cases. The department has said it would seek to provide the documents to the committee, but some congressional aides said today that it remained unclear whether the department would turn over all of the requested material. So it should be noted that the Justice Department appears to be stonewalling the subpoena issued by the House Judiciary Committee, and Jack Brooks, by the way, a Texas Democrat, is head of that committee, one of the few individuals who showed signs of vigor in the congressional probe of Iran-Contra. It should be noted that the Justice Department, and again, when the Reagan-Bush administration uses the word justice, it means just us, and they are actively stonewalling and resisting these congressional subpoenas. There have been threats by Congress to cut off funding for the Justice Department if this kind of stonewalling continues. One of the individuals involved in this apparent stonewalling was Attorney General Richard Thornburgh, who has announced his resignation. He will be resigning soon. And this past week, his replacement was named. Research credit on the following also goes to a listener. This comes from Thursday, August 8th of 1991. This is the San Francisco Chronicle. And from the Chronicle Wire Services, we find in the National Report section the following small article. This is Dateline Washington, headlined, Replacement for Thornburgh Announced. It reads in part, Attorney General Richard Thornburgh will resign soon, quote-unquote, and be replaced at least temporarily by Deputy Attorney General William P. Barr, B-A-R-R, the White House said yesterday. Skipping down in the article, Barr, a Deputy Attorney General since 1989, worked for the CIA from 1973 to 1977. In 1982 and 3, he was on the domestic policy staff at the Reagan White House. From 1984 to 1989, he was in private practice in Washington. I do not know in what capacity William Barr worked for the CIA. The concept of an ex-CIA agent is among the most dubious concepts of all. It's interesting that we have an ex-CIA agent, quote-unquote, succeeding Richard Thornburgh, at least for a period of time, as Attorney General. Richard Thornburgh, one of the people involved with the stonewalling of the Inslaw case. And the stonewalling, I should say, of the documents requested by the House Judiciary Subcommittee, House Judiciary Committee in connection with the Inslaw case. We're going to be taking a look at another example of how the Reagan-Bush administration interprets justice as meaning just us. We're going to take a look at some really frightening information concerning the background and operations of Judge Clarence Thomas, nominated by George Bush to succeed Thurgood Marshall on the Supreme Court. We're going to go into this information after a musical break in just a minute. We're now going to proceed with the prepared portion of tonight's broadcast. We have just reviewed a large portion of the prepared portion of last week's program. And again, for the benefit of those who are listening on tape, last week was August 11th of 1991. This week, of course, is August 18th. The prepared portion of last week's broadcast, as you've just heard, was devoted in considerable measure to examining some of the intersections between a number of ongoing investigations, including and especially the BCCI, the investigation of the Bank of Commerce and Credit International, various aspects of the Iran-Contra scandal, including the trial of Manuel Noriega, the so-called October surprise, the apparent deal cut between the Reagan-Bush campaign and the Khomeini forces in Iran to withhold U.S. hostages and assure Jimmy Carter's election defeat in 1980, and also the Iran-Contra scandal proper. The intersections between these are fairly well documented, and apparently they have not escaped the notice of other researchers as well, including, unfortunately, a researcher who is no longer among the ranks of the living. One of the more important and, frankly, chilling stories to emerge in the news during the past several days or the past week or so was carried in the San Jose Mercury News of Wednesday, August 14th of 1991. This is an article by John Aloysius Farrell, F-A-R-R-E-L-L, of the Boston Globe. It's Dateline Washington and headlined, Writer Probing Reagan and Bush Scandals Found Dead. And it reads as follows. To his family and fellow conspiracy buffs, Danny Casolaro, C-A-S-O-L-A-R-O, called it the octopus, quote-unquote, a shady set of connections he was tracing that appeared to link a series of scandals from the Reagan and Bush administrations involving Middle East arms deals, drug trafficking, and political corruption. As he set off for West Virginia last week, the 44-year-old writer told his friends he would be meeting a source who would give him the solid evidence he lacked to prove his suspicions. He also left them with a warning, quote, he told us, if there was an accident and he died, not to believe it, unquote, said Casolaro's brother Anthony, a physician in the Washington suburbs. Anthony Casolaro recalled his brother's words when Martinsburg, West Virginia police called him Monday with the news that Joseph Daniel Casolaro had been found in a bathtub in a Sheraton hotel room there. He had bled to death from severed arteries in his arms, his brother said. The police had first concluded that the death was a suicide and had the body embalmed. But when told by his family and investigative reporters what Danny Casolaro had been working on, the police promised an autopsy and further investigation and clamped a lid on the case. A preliminary report from state medical examiners is due today. On Tuesday, former Attorney General Elliot Richardson called for a federal investigation. Quote, "It's hard to come up with any reason for his death other than he was deliberately murdered because he was so close to uncovering sinister elements in what he called the octopus," unquote, said Richardson, whose clients in a politically charged lawsuit here helped Casolaro in his work. According to his friends and family, Casolaro was primarily working on the case of Inslaw Incorporated, that's spelled Inslaw Incorporated, a small software company that has won several rounds of an ongoing 8-year legal battle with the Justice Department and has Richardson as its lawyer. It was during his investigation of Inslaw that Casolaro found what he saw as tenuous links between the Reagan administration officials in that case and at least three other political scandals, his brothers said. They included the collapse of the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, which reportedly used branches in 69 countries to hold and launder money for drug traffickers, terrorists, and the CIA. The Iran-Contra scandal, in which the Reagan administration sold arms to Iran and used the profits illegally to finance the Nicaraguan rebels. And the so-called October Surprise, in which representatives of the Reagan-Bush presidential campaign are alleged to have dealt arms to Iran in return for a promise that 52 American hostages would not be released until after the 1980 elections, thus preventing President Carter from bringing the hostages home as a popular, vote-winning October Surprise, quote-unquote. According to Anthony Casolaro, the Octopus was not some secret organization, but his brother's term for a small group of individuals, some of them American, who participate in the clandestine operations as mediators or fixers with profit as a motive. Quote, "He didn't envision them as a group like the mafia, more as a network. They would overlap when their needs coincided," unquote, he said. Using the analogy, BCCI would be one arm of it. The October Surprise, Danny said that was literally just another arm. Inslaw is yet another arm, unquote. Inslaw alleges that Reagan administration officials conspired to steal a valuable software program from the firm and sell it to foreign governments. Inslaw says the Reagan administration then tried to put it out of business when its owners fought back. A U.S. bankruptcy judge concluded in 1988 that the Justice Department indeed stole the software through, quote, trickery, fraud, and deceit, unquote, and improperly tried to push Inslaw into bankruptcy. An appeals court ruled in May, however, that the case should have been tried in federal district court, not bankruptcy court, forcing Inslaw to start over in its litigation. Well, obviously, as you've just heard in the prepared portion of last week's broadcast, and as I've spoken about in a number of other programs, there are many very strong intersecting links between some of these various scandals. It should be noted that there are a number of things that should be taken note of in connection with the Inslaw case as opposed to some of the other investigations. Most notably, the House Judiciary Committee under Jack Brooks has subpoenaed documents from the Justice Department. And it should be noted that the Inslaw case will be investigated by the House Judiciary Committee. There has been an investigation announced by the House Foreign Affairs Committee, headed up by Lee Hamilton. Lee Hamilton, unfortunately, proved less than vigorous in his pursuit of the Iran-Contra scandal. Plus, the House Foreign Affairs Committee cannot get involved in impeachment proceedings against the president. The House Judiciary Committee, on the other hand, could conceivably do that. It should be noted that the Attorney General, formerly Richard Thornburgh, now William P. Barr, an ex-quote-unquote CIA agent, has been actively stonewalling the House Judiciary Committee's investigation. It should also be noted that although Elliot Richardson has called for a federal investigation of the death of Joseph Daniel Casolaro, with William P. Barr, who, according to his own resume, worked for the CIA from 73 to 77, it should be noted that during that period, George Bush was director of CIA, or during part of that period. It is questionable whether an investigation, a proper, impartial investigation, could be conducted under the circumstances. But I think the Inslaw case is potentially, although not as sexy, perhaps, as some of the other aspects of these investigations, the Inslaw case itself is perhaps the most important, potentially, in terms of actually precipitating some sort of removal of George Bush from office, in that, as I said, it is under investigation by the House Judiciary Committee as opposed to the House Foreign Affairs Committee. And as such, if some of the connecting links between Inslaw and October Surprise and some of the other scandals were to emerge, it could result conceivably in the impeachment of George Bush.